Many years ago, I ran across this story. It's about a church school teacher who's trying to prepare a lesson about how you should be prepared and how you should work diligently. And she thought she would use squirrels as an example of prepared workers. She went into her class and began like this. I'm going to describe something, and you raise your hand when you know what it is. I'm thinking of something that lives in trees and eats nuts. And no hands went up. It can be gray or brown, and it has a long, bushy tail. And the children looked at each other, and still no one raised their hand. It chatters, and sometimes it flips its tail when it's excited. And finally, one little boy shyly raised his hand, and the teacher breathed a sigh of relief. Okay, Michael, what do you think it is? Well, it sounds like a squirrel, but I guess the answer is supposed to be Jesus. Now, jokes are funny to us because they usually give us an exaggerated reality to think about. But, you know, I'm not so sure that this reality was that exaggerated, because often children and young people and sometimes a lot of adults quickly learn that when you're in church, there are certain types of acceptable answers. And it's often assumed that we're not supposed to bring up questions, especially about things that don't seem to make sense. Some of us have found out that if you do that, the question might be explained away in a real brief kind of way. Or worse, you might get labeled as a troublemaker for just bringing up a question that's hard. But when I looked at this gospel, I have to tell you that I'd be lying by omission if I pretended that the lesson for today was an easy one to understand. Now, in our church school classes, we try to engage our students in questions of all kinds. And we try to listen to the questions that they bring up. We don't avoid hard truths. We don't pussyfoot around a story that may include someone's death. We let them think about that, and we let them bring up what it is that they need to talk about. Another difficult thing to think about is God asking someone to take a long trip through a desert to a place that God hasn't even named for them yet, and how that might be full of hardships and difficulties. And we let our students think about that. We leave those stories open and let them speak to the experiences of the children themselves. And if you think you're going through hard experiences, our children are going through them too. The interactions which occur between teachers and students in those cases deeply touch our lives, both the lives of the students and the lives of the teachers who are at the front of that classroom. And so I'm going to invite you today to do the same kind of exploring with me as we search out many of the possible meanings for that gospel that we just heard. And so, sometimes a parable is like a box. And this particular parable is at least 2,000 years old. And parables, by their very nature, can be interpreted in many ways. There's no one meaning to them. Remember that little story? It sounds like it should be a squirrel, but don't you want us to say Jesus? Well, maybe and maybe not. Parables, sometimes you're ready for them, and other times they're tight and closed. But it's always ready and willing to have you come back to investigate it. Sometimes there's a suggested meaning to go along with the parable, And sometimes the comments that are added to it don't really help all that much. So when we look at a parable, perhaps the first thing we want to do is look at what's the plain meaning of what we're reading. In this case, we hear that there's a rich man who had a manager, and it's been reported to him that the man was squandering his property. So he says to the manager, "Give me an account of your management. You're no longer going to be employed by me." And I begin by wondering, were those charges against him true? Who brought them? Would there be any way for that manager to justify himself? Or is this already a done deal? The manager is the one we hear from next. "What will I do now that my master's taking my position away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I've decided what to do. I will do something so that people will welcome me into their homes when I am dismissed." Maybe the charges were true, maybe they weren't. But the man evaluates his current position and possibilities for future work and decides to maximize his chances for future employment. So he summons the debtors one by one. "How much do you owe?" 100 jugs of oil. "Write 50. "How much do you owe?" 100 containers of wheat. "Write 80. So we see that his game plan then is to make friends with the master's debtors by decreasing their indebtedness. That puts a smile on their faces. But think about it. Would you hire this particular guy to manage your inventory? The master commends the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. So maybe it's because the master sees that this fellow is finally learning how to play the game. And I wonder, would these debts have turned into bad debts had not the total owned been pared down? There's a bit of confusion here, to be sure. And don't forget, it's a parable's job to give us familiar circumstances, familiar imagery, and then twist it to get us thinking. So, what point is Jesus trying to make here? Then we have the comments about the parable. "The children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than are the children of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it's gone, they may welcome you into eternal homes." I found that the theologian Eugene Peterson helped us with this particular section quite a bit because he's paraphrased the entire Bible, and his paraphrase of this sounds like this. Now, here's a surprise. The master praised the crooked manager. And why? Because he knew how to look after himself. Streetwise people are smarter in this regard than law-abiding citizens. They're on constant alert, looking for angles, surviving by their wits. And that brings to mind a character from Oliver Twist, the Artful Dodger, who was very much that kind of a person, alert, looking for angles, trying to survive by his wits. Peterson goes on, I want you to be smart in the same way for what is right, using every adversity to stimulate you to creative survival, to concentrate your attention on the bare essentials so you'll live, really live, and not complacently just get by on good behavior. Now, I return to the way that we heard this story continue from here. Whoever is faithful in very little is faithful in much. Whoever is dishonest in very little is dishonest in much. If then you've not been faithful with dishonest wealth, who will entrust you with true riches? And if you've not been faithful with what belongs to another, who will give you what is your own? No slave can serve two masters, for the slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Peterson puts it this way: if you're honest in small things, you'll be honest in big things. If you're a crook in small things, you'll be a crook in big things. If you're not honest in small jobs, who will put you in charge of the store? No worker can serve two bosses. He'll either hate the first and love the second, or adore the first and despise the second. You can't serve both God and the bank. Now, in and of itself, money and wealth are neither good nor bad. They're tools. Tools to use for your own welfare and that of others. For families, friends, charities, the building up of our communities. Wealth is both a blessing and a responsibility. And we're told throughout Scripture that we have been blessed so that we can be a blessing. And we're held accountable less for what resources we've accumulated than for how we use those resources. From this point of view, perhaps the shrewdness or prudence of the manager comes through his recognition that he has overly valued amassing great amounts of wealth to the detriment of developing wholesome relationships. It may be that he earned his money by charging interest on the amounts his Lord loaned out to others. But now, finding himself between a rock and a hard place, he cuts the amount others owe him by the amount of his surcharge, thus avoiding further accusation that he's defrauding the master. But perhaps strengthening and perhaps even establishing relationships that will help him in his time of need. Another thing to remember about wealth: wealth, along with status and power and privilege, is all fleeting. We see this manager one day on top of the world, and the next day he's facing disaster. When we hear that we cannot serve God and mammon, or God and the bank, we might remember that whereas the Lord's attention, care, and providence are always constant, wealth proves to be pretty fickle, and ultimately it's a very untrustworthy master. So, having looked at all that, is God in this story? In times of crisis, God often appears where we least expect God to show up. There are lots of crises in the Gospel of Luke, and I'll just name a few of them, because usually in those crises, it turns out that you receive help from a very unexpected place. We heard about the Jewish traveler who's beset by robbers and left for dead, and it's a Samaritan who helps him. There's a story of a rich man who begs for help from Lazarus, a slave he has totally ignored when they were both alive. And now we see this manager suddenly dependent on those who used to look to him for a loan. God regularly shows up in places where we least expect God to be, so that we're not tempted to place our faith in the wrong place. And perhaps this is one of the keys to this passage. We're placed on earth to love and care for each other, not to separate ourselves from each other with wealth and status and privilege. I heard it said that St. Augustine asserted this: God gave us people to love and things to use. And original sin manifests itself when we confuse the two, when instead we love things and use people. So, who is this manager anyway? It seems that this unjust, dishonest, and shrewd manager is the one person in the whole story who offers forgiveness. Among all the other elements of this story that we can think on, perhaps this too is one of the keys to its meaning. There's an element of forgiveness here and a change in the attitude toward wealth. The manager no longer sees the almighty God, dollar as his God, but rather he begins to use wealth to help others rather than to hoard it away himself. Maybe he's promoting friendship not just for himself. Maybe he's also promoting friendship for his current master, because after all, he is the master's agent, and ultimately, what he does points back to the master. Maybe we too need to remember that money and wealth and influence can be used to foster, develop, and promote friendship. We shouldn't be using it to form unhealthy dependencies, but instead to form real bonds between people. Is there more to learn from this parable? You bet there is. But what I'm going to do next is tell you that when we present stories such as this to our children in class, we always leave them with questions to ponder. And so, that's what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to ask, what part of this story do you like best? What part of this parable is most important? And you might have different answers to these questions. What part of this story is about you, or where do you find yourself in the middle of this story? What part of this story could you leave out and still have all the story that you need? Be honest with yourself. You might be astounded at the answers you come up with.